Let me start out by saying that I'm here in front of you because of high school teacher. Probably a high school physics teacher more than anything else, but maybe a high school physics and math teacher. And actually, I never really told the high school teacher how he transformed my life, because I'm a physicist. My life would have been completely different without him. However, when I won one of these prizes, not the one he mentioned, I had a chance to invite people, and I knew through my brother, who lives in the same area where I grew up, where he was, and I tried to invite him to come to it. But unfortunately, by the time I came to do it, he was too old and ill to come. So indirectly, I did tell him, but I didn't tell him directly. So you have a chance to transform people's lives. Yes, I was transformed by a high school teacher. Now, I thought I would start out with this picture, because this picture is a picture taken at the University of Ottawa. And they used the picture for a national advertisement. Each week in the national newspaper, they would take a picture of a professor or a professor and some students, and they covered half a dozen professors at the University of Ottawa. And mine, they had catching electrons. This is their view, the photographer's view of catching an electron. And you can see the electrons in the hands. There's three of us there. And the names are Julien Bertrand, he's catching that electron, and me, of course, and Sarah Golan, who's catching the other. And when that came in the national newspaper, then a high school teacher in Ottawa immediately emailed me. I had an email the next day. And he said, would you be able to come to my school and give a talk to a group of high school students? I'll bring them in to a special lecture, and you can organize when you wish. And so we did it. Actually, not the three of us, but Sarah and myself and another student in the group who wants to be a high school teacher, as a matter of fact, so I thought he would be appropriate. So we did this, and what I'm going to tell you now is, to a certain extent, the presentation we gave, not exactly. I also asked them for advice and what to tell you, because I knew it was coming here. And so it's what they said influenced me. And the presentation had two pieces. I'm only going to give you one. One was given by me, and it's going to be on this part, on what the science is. And one was given by the two students, and that was the life that science is like. From their point of view, a student's point of view, but they have some sense in what the life in real research science is like. And I interjected a few times, because I think the life of a real scientist is very different than almost everybody thinks it really is. And it's much more social, for example, and it's very different than the idea of somebody going into a dark laboratory all by himself in a white lab coat. It's really more social than almost anything you can imagine. So I won't give you their presentation. I have taken the first page of it, and I might put it at the very end, and just to show you the sense for what they did. Okay, so the advertisement in the national newspaper, it was called Catching Electrons. Of course, you can't catch an electron. And I called mine Atto Science to give you sort of a pet name for it. Many people are calling this Atto Science now. I guess it makes you think of nanoscience. And I'll eventually tell you what an Atto second is. Many of you probably know, but just in case, I'll tell you as we go along. So let me start out by a picture of milliscience and remind you of something that maybe you know about already. This is actually the front page of Scientific American in 1878. If you look carefully up there, I think it's October the 15th or 19th. I got a bad angle, but. And this is a picture by Edward Muybridge. I think this is the first movie, or more or less the first movie ever taken. He was at least, the story goes, I don't know how much it's true, because I've read somewhere that this might be apocryphal or partially apocryphal. He was motivated by the challenge that was given by Stanford University, not so far away, who was the governor of California, I think. And Stanford was interested in racing horses, and he wanted to solve a problem of his day. Did a racehorse, for at one point, have all the feet off the ground when it's trotting? And this was solved by this picture. And similar pictures like this, movies of a moving horse. So a major problem of the day was looked at in this way. So I call that milliscience. Of course, progress came, and I think everybody has seen these images. These are images by Harold Edgerton, I think he was from Nebraska. And these pictures, of course, are in art galleries and many other places. And so I think everybody is familiar with these. And I think that's microscience. That's taking things on the scale of a microsecond. But of course, everything transformed with the laser. So along came the laser in 1960, and all of a sudden, laser is controlling light, and we had ways to control light, make flashes that were so fast that you could arrest things much faster than a microsecond. As a matter of fact, almost immediately after the laser, by 1964, we really knew how to make pulses on the order of 10 picoseconds in length. So that's about a 10,000th of a microsecond. And over the next few years of 10 or 15 years, the duration of pulses you could make got shorter and shorter and shorter until it reached something on the order of 6 femtoseconds. I'm going to tell you what all of these things are and what happens in that time scale in a minute. And then it arrested for about 15 years. And so the pulses that you could make of light looked something like this at the end of this period. So they're light oscillations, more or less the visible. This one that I sketched was probably the best you could do, and it was in the red. And so everybody knows that light's a wave, and so the wave oscillation that you could create was just about a cycle and a half in duration. And you can't really go much shorter than that, right? You could get to a cycle maybe, and that's just about it. Or maybe you could get something that looked like a half cycle and had something underneath it, but that's about as short as you could go. And so things were at a sort of a kind of stuck. And only just recently have we learned to go faster. And I'm going to tell you how we go faster. And by the end of the talk, you'll learn how that's done. So we move down into attoseconds. And now we can make pulses that look something like that. Higher frequency and much shorter. About 50 times shorter. And that's happened over the last 7 or 8 years. So what's these timescales? What's an attosecond? Because we're going to go to attoseconds. What's an attosecond? So if you take 1 second and you divide it into a billion pieces, that's a nanosecond. So everybody knows about nanotechnology. That's if you take 1 meter and you divide it into a billion pieces, you have a nanometer. So a similar thing in nanosecond. Take 1 second, divide it into a billion pieces, and you have a nanosecond. If you take one of those pieces and you divide it once more into a billion pieces, that's an attosecond. And so the pulses that we produce now are on the order of attoseconds. I'll show you in a few minutes. It's about 100 attoseconds now. So you may want to remember that. I'll come back to it in a second. So that's one way to see how short this is. Another way to visualize it, I asked the students how they liked the way. I had 3 or 4 ways to visualize it, and they've chose these two. So you're seeing the ones the students like. So a second way to visualize it, so an attosecond is to half a second as half a second is to the age of the universe. So you can imagine how different our life is in the second world that we live in compared to the age of the universe, and equally different is the life on the attosecond scale compared to our life. Okay? So, how and why? So now I want to say a little bit about why and then how. I won't say very much about the why right now. I'll come back to the why a little later on. Well, after the microsecond, what's fast enough to really look at? Really, it's hard to make something that's big like a bullet go fast. I mean, it goes fast, our point of view, but not fast enough to make it worthwhile taking an attosecond movie of it, because in an attosecond, it's really frozen. Right? It's really, really, really frozen in time. But what happens is in the micro world of atoms and molecules and solids, there are all kinds of things boiling around on the time scale of picoseconds, thousandths of a billionth of a second, femtoseconds and attoseconds. So if you want to think about it, you could have atoms coming together in the air and colliding. Well, maybe they collide once every billionth of a second, every nanosecond. Or you might have molecules rotating inside in the air, and they rotate in picoseconds. So 1,000ths later. Or you might have the molecules in the air vibrating, or chemistry occurring, or something like that, where the atoms have to come together or apart. And that happens in femtoseconds. So 10 to the minus 15 seconds. And then the characteristic time for electrons, given by sort of energy separation, or if you want to think of it in the way that we often think about these Bohr model electrons going around in orbits, which is not exactly correct, but sort of the time scale of that is in attoseconds. The Bohr model time scale is 25 attoseconds. So we're interested in the world of atoms and molecules and solids and electrons and things like that. It's, of course, a very important world because technology, we're built out of atoms and molecules, so it's really important to us. Technology is built out of it and everything like that. However, everything as small as an atom or molecule is just too small for a photograph. And so art and science deviated at that point, really. With the laser, art and science deviated. You can't go to a museum and find some fast image of a molecule in the museum. You have to go to a textbook and read abstract science to get what happened to the molecule. Okay, but that may change again, so that's what I'm going to tell you by the end. So now I said, why would you want to do it? So I gave you just a sense that you want to study the world of atoms, molecules, and solids, or maybe even the nuclei eventually, so even faster things. So how can you possibly make this happen? So I want to just give you a brief idea of what you need to do to make a short pulse. And I sketch it here in two ways. I took a picture of a ripple. You can imagine having thrown a rock into the stream and watching a ripple go along. So it's a short pulse. Think of the ripple. It's only got a couple of cycles like I showed you before. So, and here's a little differently how you make it. Let's imagine we took light or water waves, it doesn't make any difference which, a wave of one wavelength, this is the longest, another one, and another one, all different wavelengths. You can see that. I think I'm feeding back. You can see each of them are different wavelengths. And if they were all there simultaneously and you went to add them all up, here they are just phased perfectly together and they add together. Each wave adds one to the other, making a large peak at that point. This is the interference that you see of water waves. So everybody's familiar with this kind of thing. Okay? And here they don't add quite as well, and here they add even worse, and here they get all mixed up again. And so what you do in order to make a short pulse is you have many colors of light simultaneously present, all synchronized absolutely perfectly, so that at some time all the peaks add up. So they all phase together. Now that sounds like a tremendously difficult thing to do. How would you ever get it to happen? And, of course, that was some of the magic of lasers, that lasers allowed you to control light to such beauty that you could make it happen, and that was the first jump, or the first slide down in that curve. And I'm going to show you the second one. So, the new technology. How do we ever do this? So, I want you to just stop and think about something, again, you're very familiar with. So step back for a second, and I'm going to go right back and tell you how to do it. So everybody is familiar with lightning, and you probably all know how it works, that a large voltage builds up between the clouds and the earth, or the cloud to cloud, one to the other, and it gets so great that the fields, or the force on the charged particle because of this large voltage, gets so great that the electrons are ripped from the atoms, pulled along and accelerated by this extremely high field created in the storm, and a lightning burst follows. So everybody knows that. And well, light is just an oscillating voltage, so it's not much different than the fields that are built up in a lightning storm. So again, you're familiar with this. You may not think of light that way, but light is a voltage, or it's an electric field, just like the same kind of thing as you're familiar with in the lightning. So let's see if we can make light. What would happen if we made light as intense as the fields of in a big electric storm? Well, of course, there are going to be atoms in them, all kinds, or it could be atoms in the light field. So let's shine it onto a set of atoms or molecules. I've shown you here an atom, and I just sort of sketched an electron And well, what this represents is that this light is pulling on the electron, just like in the lightning bolt, and the electron goes free. And well, the electron then gets accelerated away, just like in the lightning, accelerated away. But unlike lightning, light is a wave. And so it gets accelerated for a while, and then the wave changes its direction, and it's going to go back and forth and oscillate back and forth. So it gets pulled away, and then it gets driven back again, just like that. Right? You can imagine a cork on a water wave is another example. You release a cork, bobs up, then bobs back down again. So the electron that's released in this case is going to bob out in the light field and bob back again. And when it comes back, well, it can crash into what it left. Boom. And just like you hear the sound here, when it crashes into where it left, into the ion from which it left, it can give out a burst of light. So, well, it depends on the details of when it goes, when it comes back, and how hard it hits, and how loud or how short wavelength that burst of light is. And so there's a sequence of bursts of light possible, probabilities of creating these light bursts. And well, it starts at the red, the longest wavelength possible, not really red, but redder, longer wavelength, and goes bluer and bluer and bluer. I represent them by red, green, and blue in this figure. But well, the energy of this crash is more energetic than ordinary visible light. So it's really ultraviolet, represented by red, deep ultraviolet, or maybe soft X-rays, represented by blue, and even harder ones represented by green, and even harder ones represented by blue. So in this, seems like a really unlikely process, isn't it? You probably can't imagine that this is going to do anything very useful, just taking an atom out, driving an electron back, and having it crash. But this is the process that happens inside an atom when it's irradiated by a strong light field. And you can see, well, I've found a way to synchronize these beams perfectly, one after the other. I know exactly when they're going to come. And well, I've got them sort of ordered, the red, the green, and the blue, symbolically, the shorter wavelength. And I could probably find a way to get them to overlap just right, and exactly that's what you can do. So there's actually three things that can happen in this case, and so I want you to keep them in mind. So one is when the electron comes out, it comes back, and it crashes exactly like I said, makes a bang, which is a flash of light in this case. That's one case. That's one thing it can do. I'm going to show you a different way to look at that in a few minutes, but this is one way to look at it. The second thing is sketched actually on the figure. The electron can play pool, that is, it can knock another electron out. So I called it play pool, just like you would in the pool hall. Cannot come back and bang into the second electron and knock it free. And the third thing it can do is it can come out and it can just be deflected by the ion. The electron and ion attracted to each other and the electron deflected. So keep all of those three things in mind. It's kind of, it can make a bang, it can be deflected, or it can play pool. Those are the three things this electron can do. And it's going to turn out that each of them are kind of important. Okay, so that's just to make sure this is clear. There's not very complicated. This is just to make sure it's clear. It's a marble released on a teeter-totter. It rolls downhill, but the teeter-totter goes up. It gets some momentum as the teeter-totter's flat. It moves back uphill a little bit more, but it's going uphill, and then back it goes. And then details of when it's left depends on when it comes back and hits the center again. So it's really a marble and a teeter-totter. Can be thought of from the simplest physics. If you're teaching your students F equals MA, they can understand a great deal of this problem from F equals MA. I'll give you a quantum mechanical view in a second, but that's the process, and that's going to give us attosecond pulses. Okay, so you had to accept that the light comes out from that. I'm going to give you a way that you don't have to take it completely on faith, but I want to just tell you that how the attosecond pulse is produced. So I showed, or I said, I sketched earlier what could be done with the best laser pulses as of, about 2000, before this came down. And you can make pulses I sketched that look a bit like this. So let's think about what happens if you take that pulse and try to create this ionization and so on. Well, The pulse goes along, it irradiates an atom, and at some point, the light field or the voltage on the atom or molecule gets so great that the electron is pulled away, and it does exactly what we said, and it gets this large increasing electric field or voltage, pulling it away, driving it back, and it collides with a high velocity, making a loud sound. So bright light and at very short wavelength. Now, of course, if it doesn't ionize there, it might ionize at this half cycle, and it gets also pulled away, but it's with a decreasing field or with a decreasing force, and it's pushed back feebly, and it comes back, and it barely hit. It doesn't hit nearly so sudden. So if you put in a filter that would allow you to only hear the bright, loudest sound or the shortest wavelength light as the analog, you only see one burst. And that's the key. There are other variants on this that you can use, but the whole key of making this short pulse then is controlling ionization and controlling it coming back and colliding so that it can only happen once. Okay, so now is the time that I should say, well, okay, but that sounds like a very improbable thing. One atom is not going to make much light. But if you put a gas of atoms, the light is forcing one atom to do this, boom, and then it keeps propagating along, the next one does it, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and each doing it exactly identically, and the light you produce from the first one adds to the second, adds to the third, fourth, and so on, and pretty soon it's a very bright burst. And so that's how you make intense attosecond pulses. Now, I don't know how many of you watch the television show on physics and physics geeks. I think it's on ABC. I've never seen it myself until last night. So last night when I came, so it's amazing, I sort of knew of it from my students, but I'd never seen it. But last night when I flew down from Stanford and I arrived at a friend's house in Los Angeles, he said, you got to see this show, you got to see this show. And this is a show that about young college students, they're all geeks, they're all physics, this is a physics show. It's a sitcomedy, and in this sitcomedy, and the one I saw, I only saw one episode, it was an episode about setting up a team of people for a science quiz. And these guys are all geeks, right? It's all about geeks and physics and stuff like this. I'm sure many of you have seen it. If I knew the name of it, I would tell you. Big Bang Theory, that's what it is. I should have remembered, Big Bang Theory. So the first question they were asked is, what is the shortest light pulse that can be produced on this episode? That's why he showed it to me. And the answer was 130 attoseconds. The show was last year's. And it was right last year, but now it's seconds, right? Now it's 80 attoseconds. So if you get asked this next time, you know what the answer is. 80 attoseconds is the current state of the art. So, but it was really a fun show. I'm going to have to get the videos of this and watch the others. So, I had never seen it before. So that's and this is the way it's done. So you could say, okay, so let's make movies. But I already said that there's some other problem here, and that is, how are we going to deal with this really, really, really small scale, because atoms and molecules are so small, right? And I can't make a movie because the wavelength of the light is huge compared to the size of the atom. We heard that last time. And well, you maybe say, let's take it over and over and over again and try to do what was done we heard last time, but you know, on a dynamic problem, this really wouldn't work. You have to fix it and hold it and things like that. So can we find a way to make a movie? Well, so that takes me back another part. So I'm going to have to go back to electrons once more and make it just slightly more sophisticated. So, like light, electrons and even atoms are waves, or have wave-like properties, maybe I should say. So you can think of them as waves in many ways. So I say often we think of electrons as little planets, but really they have wave-like properties. So can we use the wave-like properties of the electron? And I want to give you another view of this whole process, but with a wave-like view. Okay, I want to say it in a more quantum mechanical way, and I don't really know if high school teachers think about quantum mechanics a lot or not. So I'm going to give you it, and they'll try to keep it simple, and maybe it'll work and maybe it won't. So I don't think I presented this to the students, but I thought I would add it in here, because this is a better way. So if you take the atom and the electron bound in the atom, now it's not a classical particle, but it's a wave. It occupies it's a wave function. This is the electron, and you put this intense light pulse on, and you're ready to pull an electron. You don't really pull a classical electron out. You create a wave packet out here in the continuum. There's some probability of the electron coming out. It's a wave-like probability. And there's some probability the electron stays behind. In a way, it would not be much different than taking a glass of water, and you got this glass of water, that's the electron. Think of the water inside. I didn't put water in this. And I'm going to tip it in the light field, and eventually I come to the point where some of the water tips out and some of the water stays behind. That's what the electron does. Some comes out, some goes down. Some stays behind, but instead of just falling to the ground as the water would, the electron does, the part that tips out, does something like I described to you. Comes out, comes back, and collides back again. But when it collides, instead of thinking of it as a bang, think of it a little differently, because these are two parts of the same electron, and when they come back, they overlap. And when things overlap, well, waves interfere. And so there's an interference between the wave function that's left behind and the wave packet. These are just the technical words. Come back. The two pieces of the same electron must interfere. Okay, so it's a bit like an optical interferometer, and I don't know how much you're into optical interferometers, so this may not help you. But if you are into them, and if you think about optical interferometers, this is an extremely valuable device. It's used everywhere in optics, almost everywhere. And well, again, if you're into it, interferometers allow you to determine almost everything about the waves involved, almost everything. And so that means I could tell you everything about what the electron looks like behind, if I understand this interferometer well, and everything about the electron that came out. In other words, I could take a picture. Right? So that's an amazing thing. So I'm going to show, well, there is a picture of an electron from a nitrogen molecule, and I'm going to work my way down to that. I won't tell you all the details, but I want to work my way down to it a little bit. So I've made this interference inside the atom. You're going to say, how am I ever going to see it? Because there it is inside the atom. I can't see it. What am I going to do? How am I going to find it? Well, it's really that burst of light that I talked about that is seeing it. So let me try to explain that to you. I took the electron out of the atom, or piece of it. I brought it back. I'm now going to sketch the wave instead of just the particle coming back. I'm going to sketch the overlap of the initial wave function, with the wave packet coming back, the two pieces of the same electron. And, well, waves interfere. And so here, I've got a valley overlapping what was once the Gaussian. So I have to subtract the two. And now I got a peak overlapping what was once the Gaussian, so I got to add the two, and so I've sort of distorted. The sum is distorted, if you like. The sum has got more probability on one side than the other. If I square it and I look where the charge lies, it lies preferentially on one side of the atom or molecule. And just a moment later, it's moved, just because it's coming back really fast, it's moved slightly ahead. And now where once I had a peak, I now have a peak, and where I once had a peak, I now have a valley. And so as this electron moves through the atom over and over again, the charge is jiggling back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and an oscillating charge gives out light, and that's the light that we're talking about. That's how the sound comes out, right? Sound wasn't a very good analog, because it's obvious that I make sound, but how's that much light? So this is the way it's really done. And so you actually see that the amplitude of this oscillation and the phase of that oscillation is transferred to the light through this dipole, through this transition. And so this is a very valuable piece of information. And so we can read this interferometer by looking at the light it created, the attosecond pulses, or it could be a sequence of attosecond pulses for this case. So now I've taken you towards how to read it. And how electrons, of course, are short wavelength. Or you saw them, short wavelength on the scale of an atom. So now we're about ready to take pictures. So now I want to tell you about how to take pictures. So I said, so just like light, electrons can take pictures. I just want to remind you how it's done. And I want to remind you of things that you probably already know about interference. And I've already implied lots of things about interference before. But probably lots of schools have wave tanks with two sources of waves being produced in a wave tank, and you probably all have looked at these interference patterns. And interference patterns on water waves are no different than interference patterns with light waves, which are no different than interference patterns with electron waves. Okay? So, let's imagine now we take a molecule, we take the electron, we do exactly what we said, we pull it out, we drive it back, but it's a wave coming back, you can see it represented by a wave, and it crashes against the molecule. It's exactly the same case as there. So we should see a diffraction pattern, just like you see there, we should see exactly the same kind of diffraction pattern here. Okay? So that's going to be one way to take a picture. So there are three ways to take single frames, and you've now been introduced to them, but I'll come back and introduce them just again, just to make sure you see it. One is the electron coming out of the atom, and there's information on when it comes out. It's called tunneling. So electron, when it tunnels from the atom or molecule, when it crashes back in and it elastically scattered, that's the diffraction that I just showed you before. And the third one is going to be when it emits light, and it has that information because of the oscillating interference pattern that I talked about. These are going to be the three different ways, and each of these ways will allow one to take a single frame of a movie. Ultimately, we have to put them together and make a movie, a single frame that could ultimately be put together into a series of frames, making a movie. Okay, so how am I doing for time, just so I have a sense? 10 minutes, okay. 20 minutes, okay. 10 minutes, I thought it was challenged, but 20 minutes, that should be fine. So tunneling, again, I don't know, I think everybody knows about an STM. I think STM, scanning tunneling microscopes, I understand have transformed how teaching is done for atoms. Students can really see what atoms look like in the surface. So if you don't know, I'll just make sure, but just to make sure, STM, you take a very sharp tip, metal tip, there are variants on this, but let's take a metal tip, you put a voltage on it, it's so sharp that it comes down to essentially a single atom at the tip, so it's a challenge to make these things, but people know how to do it, and you bring it close to a surface, put a voltage on it, bring it close, and you ask, as you move it across the surface, you watch the modulation in the current. And, well, tunneling is a difficult thing to do, so if the atom is above an atom, you get a better, it's more easy to move. There may be details in this that are not quite right, but roughly it's guessed. And as you move it across, less likely to tunnel, more likely, less likely, more likely, and you can see the atoms in the surface and where they are, and you can just raster scan and pick up atoms one by one, and these images are everywhere. So we see atoms, people know how to see atoms on surfaces, by tunneling. Tunneling is a beautiful technique that allows it. So, tunneling is one of the simplest ideas in quantum mechanics. The electron just flows from one to the other through the vacuum where it shouldn't go, but because the distances are so small, it can do so. So, we have much the same thing here. We have the laser, it's not exactly a tip, it's like a surface, and we have a molecule or an atom. I'm going to take a molecule. And, well, I'm going to have the electron tunnel from one to the other, and what's the analog towards moving across the surface? It would be taking the molecule and rotating it. And I should see, as I rotate the molecule, a change in the probability of tunneling as a function of angle, and that would be much the same as moving across the surface. So, in fact, that's actually, there's an image of what you might expect. So here's the molecule of an oxygen, there's an oxygen molecule, and this is what the electron wave function looks like for the most weakly bound electron. The colors there represent the phase, right? Everything's a wave, and so you can think of this wave propagating along on the surface, on the material, like you might have a wave on the surface or in a glass, create a wave, and there's a wave, and you get a standing wave, and this is what the standing wave of the orbital for oxygen. And if you try to tunnel the electron out, well, it's going to change depending on your orientation. And it's going to tell us a great deal about the structure of that orbital. And that's true what it actually does. So in order to do that experiment, we need one more thing. And I just want to introduce how to do that. I won't take a lot of time on it. So, but it tells you again how lasers give you beautiful control over the quantum world of atoms and molecules and so on, not only to see them, but to manipulate them. So now I want you to think about a molecule. So this is going to be my molecule. And it's somewhere in space, all around, just like the oxygen molecules or nitrogen molecules are in the air. And let's imagine I bring along a laser pulse that's quite intense. And remember, the light, the laser field is a force on the charges. So it takes the charges in this molecule and sort of tries to pull them a little bit over to one side. And in so doing, it provides a torque, pulling the molecule towards alignment. Similarly, let's imagine a molecule this way, same thing. I'm pulling on it, I provide a torque, pulling it towards alignment. Every molecule is pulled towards alignment, just like gravity would do this to this, just like gravity does to a pendulum. Everything is pulled towards alignment to the laser field. And as the laser changes direction, as long as the electrons can follow, the electrons will be the molecule will be pulled towards an alignment. So I have a way to go in and put my fingers more or less in a molecule and decide to align it up in space. So that means I have a way of taking this molecule and rotating it around, just like I indicated before. I can use the laser beam and create the molecule, align it like this. Once it's aligned, I'll take another laser beam and do the experiment, or I can do all kinds of variants on it. So I wanted to tell you that you can play with molecules. It's almost like putting your fingers in and grabbing a hold of them, because light pulses let you do this. Light pulses that are intense, but not ionizing in that case. So this is sketched here. I have a randomly aligned set of molecules in the air or somewhere else. I take my laser pulse. I turn on this light-induced, like gravity-like thing, create a pendular motion, and then I turn it off again when it's all lined up, and then I go back again and I find it, like all pendula, they go back through the same place later on, and I use that time to do an experiment, and I do my STM-like experiment there. So that's one way to see a molecule. The second way I already indicated, so I won't spend any time on it, the electron is pulled out, is driven back again, it can diffract, and we can see the elastic scattering of the electron taken from the molecule itself. I kind of like this image, because I always think of it as, I got the molecule, I want to see what it looks like, I pull the electron out, I ask it to take its own picture, of course I kill the molecule in the process, the electron is scattered, the molecule is no longer there. So it's like a teenager picks up a camera, takes their own picture, but of course they have to somehow, they don't kill themselves, of course, but it's taking their own picture and seeing if their hair looks good or something like that. The molecule takes its own picture, seeing if its hair looks okay. So finally is the third process that I sort of indicated, but I want to come back to that a little bit, and that's the emission of light. So here's an electron wave coming back, represented by an artist in NRC. I don't know if you like this or not. I don't really like this image, but I thought it might be useful to show. So this is the electron wave coming back, that wave packet I told you about before. And here it's caught the moment in which it overlaps the wave function from which it leaps, that moment of interference. And you can imagine, depending on if the wavelength is exactly the same as the basic structure of the orbital, here it's low and there it's low, here it's high and there it's high, the interference or the movement of the charge will be very different compared to when the wavelength is different here or here. And so we can see the structure of the orbital in the light that's emitted that way, and that interference would be very different if I took the molecule and rotated it through 90 degrees. So we measure the interference looking at the light, and it's the direct analog of tomography. Or within a simple approximation, it's a direct analog of tomography, because Misha in the back is going to correct me and say, yes, but there are differences. But in a simple approximation, it's very close to the direct analog of tomography. So everybody knows what happens in tomography. Some patient is put in a machine, and many different projections are taken on the patient, and you look at the x-rays or whatever it is coming out on these different projections through the person. And so we do the same thing with a molecule. We put a molecule in a tomographic machine for molecules. I've told you how we can take the molecule and make it align in different ways, just like the patient is aligned in different ways compared to the X-ray beam that takes a tomographic image. And here it is sketched, the different alignments of the molecule, but you know how we did it. It's just like it would be in the patient. And there is the reconstructed image of such a molecule, an orbital. This is the orbital of a nitrogen molecule, and it's measured as opposed to calculated down here. And it's measured. There are some errors in our measurement, but we have many things correct in it. We have the basic structure size correct. We have the phase correct, that is, it's positive, negative, positive, or vice versa. It's a wave. You can imagine it going up and down again. And so we measure that. So we measure the structure of the orbital, just like you do a tomographic image to measure the structure of the things inside your body. And so this is really a picture of the molecule. Okay, so I'm going to end with a couple of different ways, and I think I will just about on time when I do. I think it's important to put this in a historical context. And so I think we had a discussion before and what one does creatively and how when you take things from other people. I think in general, science is important because it builds on a body of knowledge that's created before. And what you best can do is add a little bit to that body of knowledge. So building on this huge foundation of science, and your creative part is only a little bit on top of this huge foundation. And hopefully your part will help other people build even more on this edifice. And I think that nobody is truly starts from nothing. I mean, we all build on so much knowledge before. And we take it and we use it, knowledge from the past and knowledge from our other colleagues, and we want our contribution to add to this edifice. I think that's how you judge science. So why is it important? I'd say for centuries, science has worked to measure faster and faster phenomena. So now we're at the time resolution of about 10 to the minus 17 seconds. It's really good. We have the technology for producing them. We've developed over the last couple of years the technology for measuring them. And we have now found the technology for imaging microworld of atoms and molecules and maybe solids. We're not really at solids yet, but molecules, shall I say, and atoms if we want to look at atoms. That's one thing that makes it important. The second thing I would say, for a century, science has worked to measure the structure of matter. So I'm from National Research Council in Ottawa, which was the home of Gerhard Hertzberg, who won the Nobel Prize for molecular spectroscopy in, I believe, the late 1960s. So for a while, the center of this kind of work was in Ottawa, trying to learn the structure. Actually, it's amazing. You don't have to go back much more than a century before people didn't know that molecules were made out of atoms. They didn't know very much. So this is a relatively modern, if you think about it. So, and a great deal was done through spectroscopy in the first stages. Of course, now synchrotrons dominate molecular imaging, really because the X-ray wavelength is very short. It's on the scale of the separation of the atoms in the molecule, just like this recollision electron was now on the scale of the separation. The wavelength of the recollision electron is on the scale of the separation of molecules. But of course, synchrotrons don't look with time resolution, and not all molecules can be imaged in synchrotrons. So looking forward, 130 years ago, Meyerbridge was taking the first movies. This is the one I like best. I think this is really a beautiful one. So taking the first movies, I say the plot was poor, but the image was really striking. I think this is a striking image. So now the first movies of molecules and bonds breaking and things like that are about to be shot. I don't know. I think I gave a talk at Harvard not too long ago, and Dudley Hirschbeck argued that chemistry will be taught differently because of this, just like it's taught differently because of the STM. So your teachers, you can think about whether that's true. If we get movies of chemistry and other fast things going on atoms and molecules, perhaps it will change your field. I don't know. So, of course, we're not the only people trying to take movies, and maybe we won't do there's a whole huge effort, and I mentioned the LCLS earlier, so let me just mention it in the end. Other technical advances are being made right now, and they're all pushing in the same way towards imaging. So the X-ray free electron lasers are being designed in different places around the world. The first one is operating only this month, I believe it was only this month, in Stanford. It's the LCLS, which is, I can't remember what the initials stand for right offhand. The LCLS, it's built on the old SLAC. So a good, about one third of the SLAC accelerator has been taken over to make this free electron laser. I would say the world will invest billions of dollars over the next decade to produce intense 5 femtosecond X-ray pulses, or 5 femtoseconds approximately, maybe shorter. And the reason that really justified it, whether this is a realistic reason or not, is under a great deal of debate, is the potential to take images of single molecules. So improve on what synchrotrons can do, so you could take an image of a single molecule and in principle the dynamics, if there's interesting dynamics to take on this time scale, because you would be able to excite dynamics with lasers and probe it with these synchrotrons. These are not the only two games in town. There's not just our recollision and the advanced free electron lasers. There's also work to try to produce femtosecond electrons from ordinary photocathodes, them together and diffract from materials with that, and that's being developed at University of Toronto in Canada and also with Ahmed Zewail, a former Nobel Prize winner in Caltech. So I would say by 2018, and probably before, I guess before, Scientific American will have on its front page a movie of a molecular movie, the similar to what it had 140 years ago then, it would be, or less, 140 years ago in the front page with the horses trotting across across. And we'll hopefully solve important problems of our days. Okay, so science and art may recombine. Actually, I ended it differently for the high school students. I told you I used parts from there, what I gave to them, and parts differently. I thought that I would end it for them to say, think about what's happened with the transistor. So here's an image of the first transistor 60 years ago. And of course, every student has an iPhone and all kinds of things. And think about what's happened to the transistor in 60 years and how it has transformed, actually, everyday life. And so I don't know if this will transform everyday life, but it's hard to know. Who would have guessed what was going to happen? How could you possibly have guessed what was going to happen? Who could have imagined what would happen? Similarly, the laser. Here's a picture of the first laser. Actually, this is a maser, so it's slightly before the first laser, but the first laser was equally crude looking. And of course, now there's a laser in your CD, and there's lasers every time you talk on the telephone, and lasers are everywhere. And they are transforming our everyday life too, especially in communications. So who would have guessed? And we'll have to see where this all will take us. So, I want to end up with two different viewgraphs. So first I thought I would show a group. It gives me a chance to say something that I think is, I alluded to in the beginning, that science isn't going down to a room all by yourself and working by yourself. It's really teamwork. It's extremely social. It's about the most social thing you can imagine. I think it's much more social than almost any other profession. Actually, I married a writer, and writers are... I always think a gregarious bunch, and my wife is quite outgoing. But the profession of writing is really a much more isolated profession, really. Who ever heard of a book written by multiple people? And whoever hears a paper written by one person? Almost never, right? So actually, it's really, I think scientists often are introverts, but the profession is not an introverted profession. And writers are often extroverts, but the profession is really the opposite. It's actually an interesting thing. So the people are from everywhere, from Canada, China, Cuba. You can see all the list of people. Actually, the students that I told you I took with me to the high school were very anxious to have this view graph and this list. And actually, I had used similar lists in this, but they made sure it was completely up to date when they took it to the. There's nobody from the U.S. I've had people from U.S. colleges, but not anybody that is nationally American right now. We've had other people that have been, but not right now. So the person from Cuba actually did his PhD here, and the person from Iran actually did their PhD here. So both of these are postdocs. And this is the first page of their presentation. That was the second part of the presentation to the high school. And they just wanted to take some pictures of the lab, and that was theirs. And of course, I don't have time to give you their whole presentation, but I want to end with that and leave it up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul, for keeping perfectly on time. It's unbelievable.
At a second precision, right? It's got to be right. I couldn't get it wrong.
I'm sure there will be questions.
Yes. Oh, sure.
When you talk about the light actually tipping the electron out and back and forth, yeah, and you say it comes back and slams in.
Yeah.
Is it? I think I get the slamming into another electron, but would you say it was slamming into the nucleus?
Slams into the ion, so that could be another electron. It's the whole thing. I said that the light is like a lightning flash. So light is a wave of force on a charged particle. That's really what light is, a wave. It has a magnetic component, but in this intensity, it's really only the electric component that counts. And so light is a wave of force on a charged particle. So think about the electron, and think about the force in the charged particle. As the wave gets more strong, the force gets stronger. And eventually, it pops free. Most likely right around the peak, because that's when the force is strongest. But but quantum mechanically, it'll be blurred around there. So you got to add a little bit of quantum mechanics for blurring. So it won't be exactly at the peak. It's around that peak. So then you could go home and just use F equals ma if you're a physics teacher. And you could say, let's imagine it ionized at the peak, starts with V equals zero, what happens to it? Out, and it oscillates back. Let's imagine it ionizes a little after the peak, what happens to it? Gets pulled out, but not so far, and pushed back, and crash. And that's the crash. And so it runs into the ion, which is electrons plus the nucleus, plus everything. It runs into them, and that's the collision. And you can go home and just check it out with F equals ma. It really is no more complicated than that. So it's amazing that this modern physics can be understood a great deal with high school physics, really. Yes?
I have to scale. How do you have to trade up with the temporal coherence? Is that the temporal coherence is deteriorated at such time scale, or are there any challenges to keep the temporal coherence?
So in order to make something really short, I really need beautiful coherence between a huge range of colors. In this case, for an attosecond, it would be much more than the whole visible spectrum. It's actually shorter, so I couldn't see it anyway. But it would be much, much, if I could see it, it would be much more than the visible spectrum. And this is coherent from the most blue to the most red if I want to make the shortest pulse. It would be over, I don't know if you think in electron volts, tens of electron volts. This is huge. And so this is beautiful coherent light. Now, of course, I could easily destroy it, so that you could imagine this would be very delicate. And so some of the technology for dealing with short pulses, not only attoseconds, is how to preserve this coherence so that the colors don't get out of sync, or if they get out of sync, I can correct them. So there's a deep technology. I would say, if you remember, I said lasers in 1964, we could create 10 picosecond pulses, and over the next few decades, it fell by 1,000 or maybe more. What brought it down was a great deal learning how to keep colors together, or if they started to come apart, put them back perfectly. So to try to maintain the coherence through everything you did. So I didn't try to explain that technology, but I could have. I could tell you afterwards.
Yes, I had a similar question to the person in front of me had. When the electron gets pushed out, it's coming back to the original atom it came from.
Yes, yes.
So right, the positive ion.
Yes, right back to the positive ion. So it doesn't require high density, because it can hardly miss, right? It gets pulled out, driven back again, bang. It's like coming out and hitting yourself in the face, right? Just out like that and back. And it can hardly miss. And then so this unlikely process isn't quite as unlikely when you think about it. It's only out there for a fraction of a light cycle, femtosecond, let's say, only out for a femtosecond, 10 to the minus 15 seconds. So how much can it miss? It can't miss very much. And so what comes back, if you thought about this, if I were the ion and I looked at this electron coming back, and I asked how bright a light source would I have in order to make it the same as I see this, it would have to be, you have to go to SLAC or some big accelerator, and even then you might not be able to get as bright a light source as this is, just because the electron can hardly miss.
Thank you.
I have a question about when we are making the measurements in the range of attosecond.
Yeah.
The uncertainty principle requires that you are dealing with a very high energies.
Yeah.
In this case, are we using a very high energetic lasers, or that's not related?
In this case, well, the energy you mean in this case is the photon energy. So you need very, very, very extreme colors. So the attosecond pulse that you create is something that's generally much, it's bluer than blue, so ultraviolet, and it scans up even towards the soft X-ray region. So this is a huge photon energy range, and that's what you need. You need a large range of frequencies, including some that are very short, including quite short frequencies. And that's what you need in order to do it, and that's the wide range. The intensity is a little different. It turns out that the physics to create this requires a relatively high intensity laser beam. I didn't say how high intensity it is, but the light intensity when you focus it would be, a scientific notation, about 10 to the 14 or maybe a little more watts per square centimeter. So, you know, big power plant's a gigawatt. So 10 to the 14 would be, 100,000 big power plants concentrated, watts per square centimeter is per square centimeter. So it would be, you have to be careful of watts and not watts per square centimeter, but still, this is very intense light in a normal sense. Actually, we talked about the forces. The force here on the electron, I should think of it in forces, the volt, it's 10 volts per angstrom. So you're used to 100 volts across a centimeter in a wall plug. And so this is 10 volts per angstrom. An angstrom is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. So that's the kind of forces or fields that are on the field is 10 volts per angstrom forces. The charge times that. So these are high intensity in a normal sense. But lasers can go much more intense than this. This is not anything close to the state of art for lasers. A laser now can be focused to an intensity of 10 to the 22 watts per square centimeter. So I don't think this is true, and maybe David Gross will have something to say about it. But when I was in Harvard a number of years ago, somebody said that when you fire one of these modern lasers, God has to stop and think what to do, because he's had no experience with such intensities. I don't think it's true. I think in supernovas there is such an intensity. So, but it's interesting that it doesn't happen very often, right? But anyway, it's an interesting thing that we have at our fingertips, not in my lab, but in the world, lasers that can be focused to 10 to the 22, and people are trying to go to 10 to the 24 and 10 to the 26. So these are just even. So an electron in that wave is pulled almost instantly to relativistic intensities, and then when the wave changes, it's changed and pushed back instantly almost to relativistic intensities, and even the ion at that intensity would be relativistic in its oscillation. So these are easily available, not easily, but they're available in more than one lab in the world, a number of labs, one in Canada, other labs in the United States and Europe.
Okay, we have time for just one question. Anybody?
I was just wondering, when you remove or pull these electrons from the atoms, you showed us nitrogen. Do you work with nitrogen, or is there one atom type that?
In this case, it was a nitrogen molecule. We work with a number of different molecules. But the actual, when people are trying to make, there's a whole range of technologies here, and I sort of blurred them together. So one of the technologies is the laser source itself, or light source. It's not really a laser, the light source itself. And generally, people work with atoms for that. Neon is kind of nice, And the reason is that you would like to have the light intensity as intense as possible. So you're pulling on this electron, and you don't want it to get away too early, because if it gets away too early, it collides feebly. So we get a high ionization potential atom, and neon's a good trade-off. Helium would be even better in a way, but it turns out to have, it gives harmonics less weakly. Noble gas, yeah. And noble gas got high ionization potentials, and neon is quite high as things go. So it's a good trade-off, and neon's quite often used. So we want to take a picture of an orbital in nitrogen, and you want to look at molecules, and then we choose a molecule. So we work with a number of small molecules, and people really haven't yet got the big ones. This is really just all happening now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Okay, our final speaker for the day is Rachel.